This is episode 177 of Extraordinary Women Radio. Welcome to Extraordinary Women Radio. I am your host, Cami Gellner. Women are being called to lead with voice, vitality, and vigor. Each week, join me for wisdom-filled interviews with extraordinary women living out loud and making a difference in our world. Their stories will uplift, inspire, and spark your own purpose-driven journey. Hello, my extraordinary women friends. Happy December, and happy December in the year 2020. Aren't we celebrating this final month of the year? For those of you in Colorado, we are a week out from the Colorado Gives Day, a time to support our favorite nonprofits in our state. I have already made my gift to my favorite organization, the Women's Foundation of Colorado. I'm a board of trustee on this fabulous organization, and I love what we've been able to accomplish in this year. I'll post a link to the annual report in the show notes, but here are a few of my favorite accomplishments that we were able to do in this much-needed year of support for women in our state. We rapidly provided 108 grants, totaling more than $782,000 to help women meet their basic needs during the pandemic. We increased meaningful and intentional investments in women, girls, and non-binary people of color through the launch of our Women and Girls of Color Fund. And we leveraged our trusted voice and relationships to ensure gender and racial equity remained a priority during the abbreviated legislative session, helping to pass bills related to early childcare and education, paid sick leave, and racial justice. I believe that this is my fifth year of sitting on this board, and I am proud to give of my time, talent, and treasure. I commit because when women thrive, Colorado rises. I invite you to learn more about the Women's Foundation of Colorado at WFCO.org. And if you are able, jump out to the Colorado Gives Day and donate www.coloradogives.org. And what perfect timing to bring you today's guest, Chris Putnam Walkerly. Chris is a trusted advisor to the world's leading philanthropist. For more than 20 years, wealthy families, ultra-high net worth donors, foundations, Fortune 500 companies, and celebrity activists have sought and benefited from her advice to transform their giving and catapult their impact. As president of the Putnam Consulting Group, a philanthropy advisor, speaker, and award-winning author, she's helped over 100 philanthropists strategically allocate over $500 million in grants and gifts. Wow, that's really incredible. Chris has been named one of America's top 25 philanthropy speakers for the past 3 years running. She is the author of the book, Delusional Altruism, Why Philanthropists Fail to Achieve Change and What They Can Do to Transform Giving, and Confident Giving, Sage Advice for Funders, and is a Forbes.com contributor on philanthropy. Chris's clients include J.M. Smucker Company, Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, David and Lucille Packard Foundation, Charles and Helen Schwab Foundation, Annie E. Casey Foundation, National Center for Family Philanthropy, Blue Shield of California, and the Cleveland Foundation. Let's meet Chris Putnam Walkerly. Well, welcome to Extraordinary Women Radio, Chris. It is great to have you join me today.
Thank you so much, Cami. It's great to be here.
So one of the core values of Extraordinary Women Radio is impact, creating impact, making a difference. And you've helped over 100 philanthropists strategically allocate over $500 million in grants and gifts. I mean, that's just incredible, first of all. So congratulations for that. How did you find your passion for philanthropy?
You know, that's a great question. I'm not entirely sure, to be perfectly honest, where it started. I remember back in high school, which was way back in the day, being very passionate about trying to change U.S. policy and in the third world, as we called it then, the global south, especially in Latin America, and became very involved as a student activist in El Salvador and Central America and Nicaragua and trying to create a lot of change there. In fact, it's funny, I found myself in Washington, D.C. during college. I'd organized a contingent of students from my university to travel to D.C. and participate in a demonstration, and that turned into a civil disobedience unexpectedly. So I got arrested. For civil disobedience, you know, these are like before the days of cell phones.
Right.
No way to reach anybody. Nonetheless, I board this bus where all of us are being taken off to, you know, the Washington, D.C. Police Department, I suppose. And I sit down, I look to my right, and who is sitting next to me but Ed Asner, the actor from the Mary Tyler Moore Show, which, you know, hopefully your listeners know that show and him.
I know that show.
So I spent the next like 3 hours talking to Ed Asner. I mean, I was probably 20 at the time. 21.
Oh, that's awesome.
But you know what? I know it was very fun. But one of the first questions he asked me was, what got you involved in this? Was it your parents? Like, are your parents political or whatnot? And you know, at the time, quite frankly, I didn't have the best answer. I didn't entirely know. I just knew that once I learned about injustice in the world, I felt compelled to act on it. And so I think, you know, really that kind of fuels my passion. And, you know, in philanthropy, one of the benefits, I think, of being a funder or advising funders is you get to be put in a variety of positions and places and experiences that you wouldn't otherwise have. And so it's a privilege, really, to be able to talk to different kinds of people. Like, I've, you know, worked on issues related to gang violence in California. I was in El Salvador during the Civil War. I was in Nicaragua during their presidential elections as an observer. I'm doing some work now with an organization called Barrios Unidos in Santa Cruz, California, along with, to name another actor, Danny Glover, who's a big supporter of theirs. And they're doing a lot of work on prison reform in California and all of the, you know, the ways in which the prison system is working against us, not for us. And so I guess what drives me and where I really is seeing the impact, seeing people who are at the front lines doing this work and creating change and being able to be part of it. You might be part of it for a day on a site visit, or you might be part of it because it's a project that you're working on, but it really is such a privilege to be able to connect with so many different people who are doing such good work in the world.
That's so cool. And what is the, and I want to explore this connection between activism and philanthropy. And I love that, you know, it was such a roots, you know, I mean, it really started with the roots of you taking an interest in causes, right? You saw an opportunity to, it's like, you know, there was an injustice that was happening. You were interested, you went deeper, you explored. What is that connection between when you, I mean, just even from a big picture perspective, this, when we get these seeds of desire to create change, and there's so much right now in the world that people are wanting to create this change. They're wanting this, you know, they're seeing things. They're like, you know, there's this energy rising up, and they start to get involved. What's the relationship to philanthropy?
That's a great question. I mean, I think what's really important is that we all need to recognize, I think, that we're all philanthropists, right? I mean, I'm sure all of your listeners are actively trying to promote human welfare. And, you know, we all bring talent, skills, knowledge, experience. You know, sometimes we also bring financial resources or other kinds of resources. And we can think about how do we bring our full selves to bear toward, you know, creating change. Right. And so, you know, certainly we can donate our time, we can volunteer, we can utilize our skills. We can open doors to help others and use our connections and who we know.
Right.
It's a really important one because, you know, we all have our networks, right? And there are other people who that network would really benefit them in certain ways. Like, think of, you know, nonprofit organizations in the past, like in April and May and even June, who were desperately trying to survive and figure out how to apply for the PPP loans or other federal aid. Like, think of the value of introducing a nonprofit leader to your banker.
Right.
If you have a good relationship with a banker and you can introduce them, then suddenly they have a relationship with a banker as opposed to a relationship with like an 800 number at the bank, you know? That's entirely different. And it seems small, but it's profound. It could save that leader weeks of scrambling and scurrying and fear and doubt just to have a conversation about how do I apply? What's going to happen? How do I pay this back? What's the risk? All of those things. So I just think, you know, so activism, I mean, if you think about injustice or things that you think are wrong, you can think about, you know, who am I and what can I offer to make a difference in that area? It could be what your company could do. It could be a service that you're offering. It could be advice. It could be raising awareness. You know, we all have a lot of ability to be, I guess, exercise our philanthropic muscle.
And I love that you look at it from so many different angles and encourage our listeners to look at it from so many different angles. I think of my own journey into philanthropy, and I, as a board member of the Women's Foundation of Colorado, that's been, it was a word, I mean, I had been a board member of other nonprofits in the past, but it wasn't until I was really on the Women's Foundation of Colorado that I started thinking of myself as a philanthropist. Mm-hmm. And when I sat on the American Diabetes Association board, I headed the development committee, and I brought in a lot of my connections, right? I mean, I think that's been some of my superpowers that I can bring to a board. Mm-hmm. But when I joined the Women's Foundation board, I think it's probably been 5 years ago at this point, the term of philanthropy was one that I was, you know, I had always believed that, you know, make the change, do the things that we can do. But I hadn't really thought of myself as a philanthropist, even though I'd been giving of my own dollars during that time. But I think this, you know, when I look at, you know, my community of people, I have this community of extraordinary women doing great things, and being able to bring them in and get them excited about causes that I'm excited about, and being able to open the doors to sponsorships, and being able to open the door to partnerships, all of that can be so, so powerful for every organization. And so it's that time, our talent, our treasure, all of these pieces can help all of us become philanthropists and to get creative with it, right? To get creative how we can support, how we can show up, how we can give back. So powerful.
It really is. Yeah, there's so much that we can do. And I think too often people think of philanthropists as, you know, millionaires and billionaires. You know, the example of recently Mackenzie Scott, who is the ex-wife of Jeff Bezos, the founder of Amazon. Mm-hmm. You know, she was just in the news in July for giving away $1.7 billion, with a B, billion dollars to 116, I think, organizations. And that's just the beginning of her giving, because her wealth, you know, she has so much wealth. I think she's the wealthiest woman in America, and it's growing fast. So you have to like work hard to give it away. But, you know,
I'm guessing that the percentage of philanthropists, like the high donor philanthropists, are, what's the percentage women to male? I mean, do you know those numbers?
You know, that's a really good question. I do not know those numbers. But one statistic I do know of the ultra high net worth individuals, which I found shocking, is that of the world's billionaires, as of, I think, July, only 10% had given or pledged anything in response to COVID-19.
Wow.
Isn't that stunning?
That is stunning.
Yeah. I know. And so, you know, I don't know how it breaks down women to men, but I do know that there's a lot of wealth out there that is not being tapped into from a philanthropic and charitable perspective. But also, you know, it isn't just those individuals that we need to count on to give. And in fact, of all the charitable giving in the United States, something around 65% is from individuals, you know, people like us, people like your listeners who are giving what they can. And that really does collectively amount to way more than half of all American giving. It isn't necessarily the big companies and the billionaires, although their contributions are obviously important and meaningful.
Right, right. I think that's a really interesting statistic, and it speaks to the power that we have within us to be able to create change and impact by, you know, showing up in the ways that we can with our dollars, and you know, stretching those sometimes. And I think I'm a big believer. It's sometimes those, when we are giving to an organization, having that stretch and having that, oh, that feels like a little bit more than I might think about, can be a really good thing, because it's just the commitment to stand beside an organization that you believe in, can be really powerful to move into that stretch.
Yeah, and if I could share an example with you that I think makes this point, there's a woman named Mitzi Perdue. She's a colleague of mine, and she was married to Frank Perdue of Perdue Farms, mm-hmm. Who has since passed away. And she was born into the family that created the Sheraton Hotel chain. So she is not only a very successful business leader on her own, but also a philanthropist in terms of her family's wealth. And so she gives charitably to various causes. And she was listening to someone give a speech about a lecture about child trafficking and human trafficking. Mm-hmm. And she thought to herself after listening, like, I have to help. I have to support this cause. This is so critical. I had no idea it was as bad as it is. But I've allocated all my grant budget for the year to the various nonprofits I want to support. If I give to child trafficking, I'll have to take away, you know, from the other organizations I'm supporting. What can I do? And so she immediately thought of this prized possession of hers, which was an antique piece of furniture from the 17th century in Italy that her parents had given to her as part of her inheritance. And I don't know what it was valued at, but it was valued at a lot of money. And she thought, well, I bet I could auction that off and use that asset to raise money to support anti-child trafficking organizations. And then she thought, if I could do that, I bet a lot of other people could too. And so she began this effort entirely on her own, but now has enlisted the help of others to create an online and in-person auction where she's solicited donations from people from around the world, which are things like yachts and jewelry and buildings and, you know, other possessions. And so collectively, you know, she's embarked on this effort, like volunteering her time, but really thinking about, like, how do we think big and how do we think beyond our existing budget of what we think we have to really kind of create and raise more funding and awareness. You know, she's tapped into her connections at auction houses to get them to, you know, do the auction, but at a greatly reduced rate, and all kinds of ways that she's really able to tackle. It's called Win This Fight is the effort that she's created. So it's still ongoing, but to me, it's a great example of, you know, thinking beyond what you currently have in order to create change.
Oh, I so love that. I really love that story. And it's, you think about the ripple effect of where that goes mm-hmm. by just that, you know, that moment where she was thinking, well, I've already allocated my dollars and it's going to take away. Mm-hmm. Or this whole blossoming of an idea that came up for her.
Exactly.
I mean, that's an incredible story. Thank you for sharing that.
You're welcome.
Yeah. So what, I mean, this is a crazy year, right? I mean, a year where philanthropy is actually truly needed. And, you know, I know that within the Women's Foundation, one of the things I was really proud of this year was right after, you know, right by the end of the March, we had opened up a fund. It was going to be a fund, a rapid response fund and grant to women run nonprofits in Colorado to help them serve their constituents better in this year. There was, you know, a huge need for women who were out of work, women who were in home situations where the abuse was up higher because they were, yes. You know, they were locked in, you know, domestic abuse situations. So yes. we had, I don't remember how many exactly, it was over 300 applications actually I think it was closer to 400 applications from nonprofits across the state, you know, applying for dollars from us. And we raised nearly $1 million in a very short period of time and within weeks, literally. We brought all those applications in within weeks, and by the end of April had started to distribute funds to nonprofits across our state. Mm-hmm. And so it was really exciting to be a part of that, to be able to, you know, go through the applications and look at them and move so quickly to get yes. dollars into the hands of people that needed it sooner, right? And so What are some of the ways that you are seeing philanthropists respond quickly in this year that is making an impact?
Yeah, that's great. And I'm so excited to hear about the work that you all did in Colorado. And that's been, you know, a story that I've heard from a lot of my clients and a lot of funders I know all over the country and around the world. Speed. You know, I think, and I write about this in my book, Delusional Altruism, that philanthropy can move very, very slowly. And it's been stunning and almost breathtaking to me, the speed by which many funders responded to this crisis. And also with that, I also believe a lot of philanthropists and funders have like too many steps. There's too much process and bureaucracy and all this kind of stuff and junk that they put in their way on their way to try to create change. And a lot of that has been shed as well, which helped to speed things up. So just for some examples, you know, one funder, one client of mine, the Moses Taylor Foundation in Scranton, Pennsylvania, you know, immediately made grants to organizations that were, you know, supporting the safety net and really on the front lines in their community, and just issued checks and called the nonprofit and said, there's a check waiting for you. Yeah, please feel free to stop by and pick it up at
that
convenience.
Awesome.
You
know, it was a great call to make.
I know. What a great call to receive, right?
Exactly.
You know, they didn't have to apply. They didn't have to do anything. The same foundation and others have also said, you know, don't worry about the report writing at the back end of this. We will just call you when sort of this is all over. We'll take notes and we'll submit your final grant report for you because we know that you're too busy to do this work, to do that kind of work. A lot of funders have removed restrictions on funding. So typically, you know, what a philanthropist or a foundation will do is give a grant for a specific purpose to, you know, run an early childhood education program,
right,
or to whatever, conduct an evaluation or to, you know, provide substance abuse treatment or something. Well, that's great, except when the crisis happens and suddenly the childcare center is closed and you can't provide substance abuse treatment. You can't even find the client anymore, whatever it might be. But those grants had already been given. And so these funders told those nonprofits, hey, we will remove the restrictions, meaning you can now use this money for whatever you think is most important right now. We trust you. We trust that you'll use the money well and that you'll navigate the situation and do the best that you can.
And that's fabulous because that can make the difference of that nonprofit staying in business or not.
Exactly. Exactly. Because they have to be able to pivot. I mean, and that's helpful even when we're not living through the largest global crisis in a century, right? That's helpful just when like there's staffing changes or your board chair leaves or you lost a grant that you thought you were going to get from another funder or a policy change has happened in your city and now you aren't able to do something that you thought you were going to be able to do. Like there's always change happening in the world, right, and in our organizations. And so it's really important that funders, even in, you know, non-crisis times, are providing that kind of general operating support to keep the lights on and just keep the work moving ahead.
Exactly. Exactly. Because if they go away, it creates a bigger problem. And so providing that flexibility is really good. What are some of the most important things that philanthropists can be doing and should be doing during this crisis?
Well, I think the number one most important thing is to revamp or revise your strategy. So ideally, you know, you have a strategic plan that is guiding your work. And the reason why that's really important is that, and really this is true for business as well as for foundations or nonprofits, you know, a strategy helps you understand like where you're headed. What are you trying to accomplish in the next year or two? Where are you today? And what are the 3 to 4 things you need to focus on to get you from where you are today to where you want to be? And that really should be your decision-making framework that you are using literally every day at every meeting with your board, with your staff, so that you are always focused on, is this taking me where I want to go or is something going to take me off course?
Right.
And it's present and flexible and sentient and living and breathing again, so that when change happens, you can quickly adjust your strategy and move forward. And so to me, I can't imagine how anybody can like prioritize their time or their staff's time, especially working virtually, if you don't have a current strategy. And any strategic plan, I think, that existed pre-crisis can't possibly remain intact post-crisis. And that doesn't mean you toss the whole thing out, because, you know, you were focused on helping kids get into college before the crisis. Like, that is still important. But you need to look at your strategy and say, you know, what stays the same? What needs to get tweaked? What needs to be added? Added, or mm-hmm. and what needs to be abandoned because right. it no longer makes sense?
Right.
And what needs to radically change? And then you, and that doesn't need to take a year. It can take no. a day, honestly. And I do a lot of strategy work with my clients in a couple of days because you need to adjust in real time, not just adjust your grant making and getting the money out the door, but your overarching strategy. And if you didn't have one, or you had a really old strategy, you know, that you never really looked at, I think now is the time to create one.
Right, right. And let's just chat about that a little bit, because I'm thinking of, there's family foundations that are out there. There's community foundations that, mm-hmm. that are out there. How do you guide those foundations to knowing what their truth is, knowing what it is that they want to stand for? I mean, what are some of the most important questions that you ask your clients as you're helping them, you know, put in place those strategies?
Well, I think a couple of things. One is to remember that you don't have to like figure out the, like answer that question perfectly and hold to it for the, till the end of time. You know mm-hmm. what I mean?
Right.
Very overwhelming. You could think, oh my God, what is my purpose? You know, like, right. I don't know. But like you could, instead of that, think about the next year. Think about, you know, what kind of philanthropist, what kind of philanthropic family do we want to be a year from now? What kind of impact do we want to be having as a funder a year from now? And then honestly, look at where you are right today. And what do you need to, and these are the three or four issues that we care about. We care about, you know, mental health treatment. We care about cardiovascular disease and whatever it is, right? So in a year, we want to have explored these issues, made some grants in these areas, and within a year, pick two that we want to focus on. And then a year later, you do that, and then you keep moving. You know what I mean?
So it right. It's not just you make the decision once and just keep holding course. You actually are reviewing and thinking about these questions on a regular basis.
Yeah, because to me, it's more practical, it's more helpful, it's more realistic, and it builds momentum.
Yeah, and what I love about this is this, all those questions you just asked, and kind of that journey you took us on, could be applied if you're, you know, if you're have a family trust that's giving away millions of dollars a year, or it can also apply for those of us who don't have $1 million to give away a year, but you can think about your own giving in a way, okay, how do I want to make an impact with my dollars? How do I want to make an impact with my time? And being very conscious about that, because then you can, you know, you're just not reacting to the moment of okay, I'm going to give to this organization. It's like, no, this is how I want my dollars to make a difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this is what I think a question that funders need to ask, we all need to ask, is this bringing me joy? Mm. Because I think, you know, we need to be fully engaged and excited and committed to this work. And it's not always easy. Like giving a money away sounds easy, but if you're really in it and you're dealing with tragedy, you know, is you're funding issues that are really painful, it's hard. And so, and the work, like you should be excited and joyful in as a philanthropist, and not feel, as opposed to guilty or fearful or overwhelmed or annoyed,
right?
All kinds of other things. And so,
yeah,
I think, thinking about that joy, I think, is also really important.
I love that. I totally love that. So I know the Women's Foundation this next week is our biggest annual fundraiser. We normally have a luncheon every year with 3,000 people in a ballroom, and this year, obviously, we're not bringing 3,000 people into a ballroom. And our staff did this amazing job of creating house parties across our whole state. And I'm actually hosting a virtual party because I felt I could reach more people in a virtual community than in my living room. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, they did a brilliant job of, you know, stepping back and saying, okay, how do we maneuver through this year? What needs and shifts are you seeing in the age of COVID right now that some of the foundations that you're engaged in, some of, you know, how, what are you seeing shift and change in the mix of this that helps continue the work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I love your example of turning the 3,000 person event into many, many smaller in-person events. I think you're probably going to see engagement dramatically increase as a result of that.
Mm-hmm. And we reach new people, right? I mean, I think that's a piece that I'm actually excited about. It's like people that were paying $300 to be at a table now can be there for free and give of their dollars and engage in different ways. So I'm actually mm-hmm. really excited for what can happen with this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love to hear about it after it's over. But anyway, to your point, I think the smartest philanthropists right now and business leaders are asking, the question they're asking is, what new opportunities does this crisis bring us?
Mm-hmm.
And how do we seize this opportunity to create lasting change?
Yes.
And so to me, you know, there's a lot of reasons to be excited right now about what's happening in the world, because we're so lucky, really, to be alive right now during this crisis, because we can really, it's historical, and there's so much opportunity right now to create change.
Mm.
So
I love looking at it that way.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. So flip it instead of like, you know, doom and gloom, but think about what can be changed. And, you know, a couple of things come to mind. You know, certainly there's a need for, you know, pretty significant systems change in this country. I think just take it the education system, for mm-hmm. example,
mm-hmm.
You know, people working in education have long known that there's been a crisis in education, and it has not been equitable for many people. There's awareness of the digital divide for many decades of people not having, you know, access to the internet, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, for the first time, like everybody who's paying attention or who has children recognizes this, you know, education system is hobbled together and is not working for everybody. I mean, here in Cleveland, I think something like 30% of Cleveland public school children don't have access to the internet or a device to use. And so really, I think there's an opportunity now that can be seized to really create more systemic change and improvement in the education system, in the healthcare system, in the mental health system, you know, name your system.
Right.
Because it's so abundantly obvious that there's a problem. You can't really deny it anymore.
Right. And so many of those systems were created, you know, back in the industrial age. I mean, it's like this mm-hmm. this shift that is happening is really due.
Yes. Yes. And if we can like catapult, you know, people into the outer space, you know, we should be able to, and have them come back, we should be able to, you know, make sure that every child in this country has access to high quality education. So that's one example. I think another one related is, you know, not only this pandemic has demonstrated racial inequity and racism in this country, but obviously, you know, there's been tremendous awareness now with the murders of Black men like George Floyd at the hands of police and many yes. other examples of, you know, insidious structural institutional racism that persists, and, you know, a greater recognition of that in philanthropy, I'll just say, among all kinds of philanthropists. And there has been a greater awareness and efforts in the past 5 to 10 years in philanthropy to focus on diversity, equity, and inclusion.
Yes.
So there's been a lot of work done and yes. readiness and learning and awareness and improvement. And now I think there's huge opportunity with organizations like ABFE, which is formerly the Association of Black Foundation Executives, and other, you know, organizations and associations in philanthropy that are trying to focus on anti-racism and diversity and inclusion and equity. They're really calling to action funders, and funders are really stepping up and stepping into this. I think there's been $1 billion donated to anti-racism work just since, I guess, June. So from private foundations, which is huge. And so I really do believe that there's a lot of opportunity, again, to think about, you know, what is this crisis allowing us to be able to do now that we couldn't have done, you know, last year or 3 years ago.
It's bringing to the forefront some areas where we really need to bring change. And I know within the Women's Foundation, it's interesting. We've had a lot as a board member. We've had a lot of equity training and diversity training mm-hmm. over the last couple of years. We really yeah. put a lot of focus on it. So it feels like we were. All of that training we were having was leading up to this point right now. And yeah. again, you know, back to that rapid response, we actually are creating a fund right now, a grant fund for Black women in the state of Colorado to really okay. help address some of the inequity that's happening in our state. And so, again, I totally get that there's a space that we can really step into and make a difference with that. So powerful, so powerful.
Yeah, and I think a really important point to make there is, and I talk about this in my book Delusional Altruism, is like a scarcity mindset versus an abundance mindset in philanthropy. Mm-hmm. And the scarcity mindset really talks about. You know, funders often don't invest in themselves and their own learning. They believe all the money needs to kind of go out into the community to help other people. And while that seems noble, it's really misguided and I think delusional, because to create the greatest change in the world, I think you need to become the greatest philanthropist that you can be. Mm. And by that, I don't mean, you know, you're on your yacht.
Right.
I mean, but what I do mean is, you know, you've taken the time, you've invested the resources like the Women's Foundation in Colorado did to learn about diversity, equity, and inclusion and do that hard work and really kind of take yourselves on this journey of trying to undo racism and recognize, you know, your own blind spots and what you need to do differently so that now, 3 years later, you're in a much stronger position. There's greater awareness. You've done the work. And so when these crises happen, you're positioned to seize on them and to begin working immediately. It isn't like you're suddenly going, oh, well, gosh, look at us. Apparently we're all white. We had no idea. You know what I mean? Right.
Exactly. No, I totally agree with that. And I think that even just investing into the leadership of the staff members and yes. making sure that they're in conversations across the nation so that they're bringing best ideas and, you know, working with others who are bringing best ideas. And, you know, so there's I think it's so important that visibility with other communities outside of the, you know, your own community to step into that. And that's where the growth really happens. Mm-hmm. I want to talk about your book. So your book is called Delusional Altruism. What is delusional altruism? Tell us a little bit more.
Yes. So delusional altruism does not mean that you're crazy. but what it does mean is that many funders are misguided. I've been advising philanthropists and all kinds of foundations and corporate giving programs for over 20 years. And I really believe that, you know, people are trying to make a difference, change the world, have an impact, but are often getting in their own way. And they prevent themselves from having the impact that they seek. And they often don't even realize this is happening because they're sort of clinging on to these misguided beliefs of things they think they're supposed to be doing, but it actually isn't really serving them.
Mm. And give us some examples.
Yeah, well, you know, an example would be, you know, I mentioned the scarcity mindset. Another mm-hmm. example is fear. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of philanthropists are very fearful, actually, and fear, I think, kind of feeds that scarcity mindset and really holds funders back, even during normal times when we're not mm-hmm. living through a crisis. Uh-huh. So fear of things like, you know, even like coming out in support of a cause, you know, some donors feel like, I don't want it to be known that I support whatever the issue is because other people might criticize me. My friends and colleagues at the club might not agree with me. I might get lambasted on social media, whatever it might be. And so there's this fear about kind of standing up for what you believe in. Related to that, yeah, there's a fear of kind of being known as being a wealthy donor. I was listening to a story of a woman in the UK who came into wealth unexpectedly. Her husband's business sold. Suddenly they had a tremendous amount of wealth. She wasn't really prepared for it. And it it made her fearful because suddenly everyone she knew was looking at her a little bit differently, mm-hmm. sometimes with envy, you know, and suddenly people were asking her for money and, you know, for supporting their organization. And she just felt very fearful.
And she probably froze, identity guessing, right?
Yeah.
She froze, like, where do I go?
Yeah. You know, fear of disappointing people. You know, a lot of philanthropy is saying no.
Mm.
As you probably know,
totally.
You know, there's usually more requests than there is money to give away.
Right.
So you're often in the position of disappointing people who are deserving. You know, they are doing great work, but you've run out of funding. And so there's a lot of fear. I think, you know, fear of control is, fear of losing control, excuse me, is one of those fears that fuels what I spoke about earlier, which was wanting to maintain tight controls on the grants that you're giving away, and not kind of letting go and trusting your nonprofit leader to do what they think is best.
Mm.
So I think, you know, fear really holds people back, and you can't create change and you can't bring all your talents to the table when you feel afraid.
Right.
It masks talent. It masks your skills and abilities.
And I think being in that partnership, right? I mean, it's like it becomes a partnership. It becomes a, you know, I think of some of the cohort that the Women's Foundation gives to on a regular basis. There's 23 nonprofits across the state right now that we're working with on a 3-year program. And it is a partnership, and it's a collaboration where the cohort is learning together, and, you know, they're the ones on the front lines learning and hearing the stories. And there's so much to be learned if you listen.
Mm-hmm. There really is. And I think building trusting relationships is really a key to being a successful transformational philanthropist.
Yeah.
Because, you know, as a funder, you're not usually the one doing the work. Usually you're supporting a nonprofit organization to be doing the work that is really helping you achieve your mission and your goals. And if you don't have a trusting relationship, an equal partnership, constant communication, a willingness to be vulnerable and honest about what's working and not working, then how can you possibly, you know, achieve the change that you want?
Right. Right. So some of our listeners are wealth advisors. Some of them are estate planners. Some of them are, you know, I do have some family philanthropists that are here, you know, as listeners. How can, you know, any of these groups really increase their clients' philanthropic impact?
Yeah, it's funny. I think wealth advisors contribute in many ways to this delusional altruism. And what I suggest is that they stop saying yes so often, mm-hmm. and start asking why and what.
Mm.
And so let me unpack that a little bit. So in my experience, many wealth advisors, you know, they're in the position obviously of helping their clients to grow their wealth, reduce their taxes, and perhaps, you know, maintain wealth across generations, which is great. But I think too often they'll say yes to whatever their client asks about as it relates to philanthropy. And they sort of jump into, you know, I don't know, customer service mode or something. So the family, the donor, the client might say, you know, we want to start a foundation. And the wealth advisor says, great, let me drop the paperwork. I'll get that put together in the next 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Or I want to create a donor advised fund. Great, we can set you up for that. Or I want to support my alma mater. Got it. No problem. I'll write the check and off we go. And there's no questioning of why that approach, right?
Right, right.
And so to me, that's where the why comes in, the why question, which I also talk about in the book. I have a chapter on 12 questions that I think all funders should be asking. And the very first one is why. And there's two parts to it. Part one is really understanding your purpose. So I think before jumping into the tactics of philanthropy, it's important to focus on the goals and the strategy. So why do you exist as a philanthropic family? What's your purpose? What's your philanthropic purpose? And really beginning to unpack some of those conversations and help your clients begin to understand why they want to be philanthropic. And then the what questions are, you know, we talked about before with strategy, like what kind of impact do you want to be having? What kind of philanthropic family do you want to be? what are your goals? You know, what kind of change do you want to see in your community? And those questions, I mean, that's a conversation to have. You don't necessarily figure all that out in one conversation, but
right.
It really isn't until you can help your clients understand their philanthropic purpose and what they want to accomplish that then you have to figure that out first before you can help them figure out how to do that.
Right. Right.
And so, you know, how you do it could be, I mean, you could create a foundation, but that's a lot of work. You're running a nonprofit organization. And do you really need to do that? Could you create a donor advised fund? Like, what's the vehicle that would make sense?
Right. Right. And I love donor advised funds. And I think especially right now, you know, this is a time when, you know, women can band together in a circle of women and create a donor advised fund. Just for those listening who may not know what a donor advised fund is, can you just give them a synopsis of that?
Yes. Thank you. Great question. So a donor advised fund is kind of like a charitable checking account, if you will. So, you know, let's say you have really $5,000 or $5 million that you want to use for charitable purposes. You can set up what's called a donor advised fund, and you can do that in a variety of places. Most commonly, it might be at your local community foundation, or it could be at a large firm like a Fidelity Charitable or a Schwab Charitable or Vanguard or someone like that. But nonetheless, you basically make a donation to set up your donor advised fund. A benefit is that you immediately get a tax benefit for that charitable gift.
Mm-hmm.
And then that organization that is sponsoring that donor advised fund, be it your local community foundation or Fidelity or whomever, handles all the back end stuff, all the transactions, they issue the checks, they handle all the reporting, they handle all the tax stuff for you. So you don't need to worry about all that. You can just focus on, you know, giving the money away. And so there's a lot of value to it. And it's an alternative to creating a foundation. Creating a foundation could be a great way to go, especially if you're trying to really have a large scale impact on an issue. And you know that it's going to need to involve, you know, staff and a more robust infrastructure and partnership with other kinds of organizations. They want to be able to know kind of who they're partnering with. But, you know, at the same time, Mackenzie Scott, who I mentioned earlier, who just gave away $1.7 billion, did it without any organization underneath her. She, you know, issued payments
to
organizations.
Right.
But also, there's lots of other options. You could be part of a giving circle. You could be part of a, you know, rapid response fund. You can really think about, you know, once you know your purpose and your what, you can think about, like, well, what are all the ways we can bring all of our assets to bear, meaning what I talked about earlier, your talent, your connections, your skills, your experiences. Like, how do we want to be philanthropic? And that really should follow, the how should follow the what.
Yeah, I love that. And I'm just going to do a shout out because I want to here, because the Women's Foundation does have donor advised funds.
Oh,
they
good.
Do have investment circles. And, you know, so there's lots of ways that, you know, if you're wanting to give back to women in the state of Colorado and actually beyond, we actually do a Beyond Your Borders donor advised fund within that reaches outside of the U.S. So there's so much that, you know, go explore, get curious about your why, and then go explore different places that are there. So this is so awesome. And I love this conversation, and I love, this is something I'm obviously very passionate about. And I love your passion for this work. Where can people learn more about you and your work and your book, Chris?
Yeah, so they can learn more about me on my website, which is putnam-consulting.com. And the book, Delusional Altruism, is available, you know, at retailers like Amazon and Barnes & Noble. And of course, you can go to delusionalaltruism.com to learn more about the book and find the links to those retailers. And then also I'll say, you know, one thing I'd love to share with your listeners is an article that I wrote called Six Mistakes Philanthropists Make During a Crisis and What They Can Do Differently. And that's available if you go to sixcrisismistakes.com.
Mm-hmm.
Then you can just download that easily. And I think it's a really useful guide for both donors to, you know, identify these mistakes and avoid them, not just right now, but in any future crisis, a wildfire, right, an earthquake, you know, lots of things happen. And also for, you know, nonprofit leaders to take a look at that, to understand, you know, what's happening for their, with their funders right now.
That's awesome. So awesome. So the final question I always close with are, what three pearls of wisdom would you like to leave with our audience today?
Ooh, I love it. Well, so I'd start with thinking about your strategy. So the point that I made earlier about if whatever strategy you had before this crisis can't remain intact after it, I think applies to all of us. I mean, I am a consultant and advisor, and when I sat down right after lockdown on my couch with my coffee and thought, now what do I do?
And we all had that moment.
Right. I had a moment. I thought, oh, that's right. I created a strategy like in January. Let me go pull it out and take a look at it. And I did, you know, and I thought, oh, well, a lot of this still makes sense, but most of it needs to be tweaked and adapted and changed. And so that's what I did. And I rewrote it, and then I stuck it on my wall, and I look at it all of the time. So I use that. I think all of us as individuals, as entrepreneurs, women business leaders, I think we all can think about what's our strategy and how do we use that on a regular basis to adjust ourselves. The second is to think about what's my superpower and, or powers, plural, and really think about, you know, what do I bring to bear beyond money, beyond perhaps maybe the obvious, but what are all the talents and how can I deploy them in service of whatever issue or cause I might care about? And then really to begin to do that.
That's good.
And then the third is to ask yourself this question, which is, if I could only accomplish one thing in the next year, but it was to be my legacy, what would it be?
Good.
And this is a question I ask my clients, and it's what I asked myself. And my answer was, I need to write this book. And that's how delusional altruism came to life.
Ooh, I love it. And it's interesting because I ask my clients all the time, if the whole world could hear one message from you, what would it be? Mm-hmm. And so very related there, right? I mean, it's finding that clarity in what it is that you want to stand for and really, you know, setting up the steps to go there.
Yes.
Chris, this has been so much fun. It is such an honor to hear your stories, to hear your wisdom. And I know our listeners are going to be so inspired by your words and your stories and, you know, just hopefully thinking about philanthropy in a different way. So thank you for bringing everything that you brought to the table today.
Oh, thank you so much, Cami, for having me. It's been a very fun conversation.
Have a good day. I hope you liked this episode of Extraordinary Women Radio. If you did, please share this podcast with your own special tribe of women and help spread the love, the dreams, and the inspiration. Are you ready to raise up your voice, your visibility, and your business? I invite you to join the conversation in my Facebook group, Extraordinary Women Connect. This group brings together changemaker women entrepreneurs who want to elevate their business for impact. It is a place for powerful connections and collaborations. It is a place to be inspired, uplifted, and fired up for action. To learn more about my work that helps women entrepreneurs make heartfelt connections to mindful growth strategies, visit my website at camigelner.com. Till next time, my friend, listen to your heart, follow your dreams, and be you.